The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, good evening, and can you hear me okay? Let's see, there's a little bit reverberation for me. I don't know if you're able to adjust, not the volume, but maybe the bass or something. So let's see, how's that any better, or... Everybody can hear okay? Okay. So, I'll share with you a Dharma topic that's been on my mind lately, and that is the Buddhist concept of karma. And some people consider it to be one of the central aspects of the Buddha Dharma, the Buddha's teachings. And so much so that some people think that you should study and understand karma before you understand almost any other teaching of Buddhism. The way that karma, the word karma, the concept of karma has come to the West, it's come through a lot of different means, from different backgrounds. It's a common word in India, and in India there are different concepts of karma, different ideas of what karma means. And in the time of the Buddha, there were controversies about theories of karma. And the Buddha was not necessarily part of the controversy, but it was part of the diversity of ways in which people understood this concept. And it's come into popular English now. And people, you know, very lightly sometimes use the word karma. You know, that's your karma, or must be my karma. And I suppose, I'm not sure what they mean when people say that it's your karma, it's my karma. It's a little bit dangerous because of the kind of colloquial, simple way that maybe people use the term. Sometimes it implies that you deserve it. That I did something, I did X, you know, I must have done something to deserve this. There's a cause and effect, and this is the effect, what's happening now. I have a flat tire, it's my karma. I must have done something in the past. I don't know, what past actions cause a flat tire, but maybe, you know, driving on the same tires for 100,000 miles. And eventually they wear down, and the air leaks, and you know, but is that your karma? And, you know, it's a, you know, you're partly responsible for not changing the tires and letting them wear down, but you know, it's kind of ambiguous. What do people mean? It gets kind of painful sometimes when people kind of imply this idea of karma when people are sick. It must be your karma, and like, what is that supposed to mean? And is that supposed to mean that I did something terrible in the past, and this is the just desserts for what happened? And am I somehow responsible for my illness? Another kind of popular idea of karma is the idea of justice. A lot of people would like to have a just world. It's a reasonable desire to have justice in a just world where all the good and the bad balance out, or at least all the bad gets somehow, I don't know what the right expression is, but punished. Balanced out, where, you know, that when people do bad things to each other, we want to know that somehow there's a moral calculator in the universe, that the people who do immoral things, that sooner or later they'll get their just desserts. It'll come back and bite them, because, you know, it kind of feels unjust to have someone, you know, be really bad, do terrible things, and maybe live a wealthy life and, you know, not care all the harm they've caused around them, the wars they've caused or whatever, and then they have a very sweet, happy, beatific death. You know, it's also, you know, and that doesn't seem like, that's not justice. And so some people like to have the teachings of karma provide the justice by connecting karma to rebirth. Well, they'll get it next lifetime. You know, they didn't get it this lifetime, but they get it next lifetime. And so it's a way of kind of making the world a good place by saying there is justice. I don't know if the universe is required to be a just place. I wish it was, and I'd like human beings to live with a keen sense of justice and supporting that in their lives in a compassionate way. But I think it's a big burden to put on the universe that it's supposed to be just. You know, is the universe supposed to be what I want it to be, what we want it to be? Are we, you know, is it up to us to decide, you know, to what, how the universe is supposed to be constructed? I don't know. I mean, it seems a little strange to me if that's the direction, you know, of expectation. But I think it often happens that human beings would like to have explanations for all kinds of things, and they want to have to understand the mysterious, the unknown, and they like to have order and make sense out of it. And sometimes that sense and that order is projected onto the universe, and because it gives a sense of comfort, or, you know, it's very uncomfortable to feel there is no justice. So if we look back at the time of the Buddha to see how he talked about karma, the first thing we should become clear about is that the word karma literally, or the word in Pali, the word is kamma, literally means action. And in the Buddhist texts, it mostly means, it can mean almost any kind of action, but we have to, but it also means in the text that preceded Buddhism, the ancient Vedic texts and Upanishadic texts, the word karma tended to mean ritual action, a special kind of action. So it had a special meaning. It wasn't just any old action, but it had a kind of religious or ritual purpose. Sacrifices and rituals for the gods were some of those kinds of actions were called karma. And that sense of the word karma continued in Buddhist texts in the monastic regulations, the monastic rules for monastics. And some of the ceremonies and some of the procedures of the monastics are called sometimes karma. Specifically, that's what the word action there means. It means kind of ecclesiastical actions that they do within the monastic order. But it means action. And the big question in the time of the Buddha that different philosophers, different teachers were discussing was, what are the consequences of actions? Do they have any consequences? And do we have any choice in the actions we make? And there were, in fact, some people who believed that actions have no consequences, that it doesn't matter what you do, that somehow everything's been predetermined, or everything is random and haphazard, and it doesn't matter what you do. You can kill someone, it doesn't really matter, just all kind of predetermined you know, if you don't change your tire for 100,000 miles, and the tire goes flat, it was predetermined. If you change your tires every 10,000 miles, it would have gone flat anyway, because it's predetermined to have flat tire. So this idea, so then might as well, who cares about you change it or not? Why spend all the money changing tires if your flat tire is a predetermined event? And then there were ideas that there was a gods who determined everything. And you could supplicate and pray to the gods, and maybe they would help make it rain or bring prosperity to you. But that, the actions, what really happened to you was really contingent upon what the gods wished. And they kind of, you know, they were the puppeteers that kind of orchestrated what happens in this world. So the Buddha had a very, when he used the word karma as a in his teachings, seemed to have had a very particular meaning for what he meant. And what's nice to kind of realize, I think, is that often when the Buddha taught, he was very particular about what he taught. And then what happened down through the centuries, because religious people like to generalize, like to have, you know, universal truths, they tended to make that more abstract and generalize into something bigger than maybe the particular way in which he taught. And so when the Buddha talked about karma, he talked about it as karma can have consequences. The particular actions are the ones he was concerned about. And the particular kinds of actions have particular kind of consequences. And the particular actions, when he talked about karma, the particular actions he was most focused on was something he called the 10 unskillful or the 10 skillful actions. And these 10 things are have to do with our social relationship with each other, how we relate to our community around us. And they have to do about whether we relate or have actions that cause harm to our community, to our friends and people around us, or whether we do things that's beneficial for them. And so he gave a list of 10. And the first 9 make the most sense, most directly. The first is, what's unskillful is to kill people. It's skillful to have compassionate concern for the welfare of others. It's not skillful to steal from people. It's much more skillful to be generous and caring for people, respectful of them. It's unskillful to engage in sexual misconduct, harmful sexual activity, someone gets hurt in the process. It's skillful to respect people's bodies, their commitments, their life that they, sexual life they live. It's unskillful to lie. It's skillful to tell the truth. It's unskillful to speak maliciously. It's skillful to speak kindly. Or to speak in ways that create concord. It's So the malicious, the opposite of malicious is concord, create harmony and bring people together. It's unskillful to have harsh speech. It's skillful to have kind speech. It's unskillful to have gossip. It's skillful, again, to create speech that has concord, that brings people together and makes nice connections. It's unskillful to have to be greedy. And it's skillful, and the word isn't just greedy. Actually, this is a very it's very important, the difference. It's covetive, I can't even say the English word, because I only see it in written in these books. Covetousness, is that right? Yes. Thank you. So that means to want other people's things. So you can be greedy for things that other people don't have. You can be greedy to, you know, I don't know, to go, you know, to buy a lot of ice cream. You know, they happily sell it to you. You know. But to want someone else's things is unskillful. To be generous is skillful. To have ill will or hostility is unskillful. And to have the opposite, to have goodwill, is skillful. The last of these 10 is called the unskillful action. Is called wrong view, and the skillful action is called right view. And it seems strange that all the others have to do with actions, and this one has to do with your own private, you know, philosophy or views about things. And why should that be ethical in the same way? But if you look at how the Buddha talked about wrong view, it was very much in the context of our relationship with other people. And he said that it's wrong view to believe there's no generosity, nothing given, and no consequence of giving. And there's it's unskillful to believe that there's no mother and father. And so generosity has to do with our relationship to each other. And mother and father, I don't know why he talked about that, but I could well imagine back then in ancient India, maybe there were people who denied kind of the relationship, the connection to their parents. Remember, there was a group of people back then who were world renouncers, ascetics, people who kind of dropouts from society and who left everything behind. And maybe part of their view was just kind of deny the value or something of parents. Whereas the Buddha said, no, there are parents. And in his monastic regulations, he said the monastics actually should take care of their parents up to a certain point. And certain rules that the monastics had to follow, they could break those rules if they were taking care of their parents. Isn't that nice? So it's the social, so the actions the Buddha was concerned about when he was talking about karma were the actions that caused harm or caused benefit. The list of these 10 skillful actions sounds very much like ethical precepts. And some people, when they hear these, see them more in the abstract. Oh, there's just these rules we're supposed to follow, these Buddhists and their rules, and, you know, just like, you know, it's kind of oppressive. And in the abstract, maybe. But if not in the abstract, you're talking about the social connections people have. And in those relationships, what can happen between people? And how do we care for those relationships? Because the relationship we have with other human beings are consequential, are very meaningful. I think most of us, I believe, probably don't understand the full depth of what our relationship to other people really means in our hearts, what it really means in our psychology. The connection that we have with our parents, with our grandparents, with our relatives, with good friends. When we're growing up, they're very formative. They create a huge impression that stays with us for, you know, a lifetime. I still have very deep memories of goodness and safety and love that came from simple acts of generosity and care that came from my grandmother when I would stay at her house. And she would make toast with cheese and bring it to bed when I would have breakfast in bed and under the comforter and read comic books. And I had no idea at that time that simple act of my grandmother had any meaning. I just kind of like, oh, thank you. I didn't even say thank you. But I can still feel from those memory and from that time this tremendous sense of comfort and goodness and love that somehow went into marrows of my bone almost, really deep. And so the opposite can happen as well, where someone we have, especially when we were young children, we have parents or grandparents or relatives or someone, friends, who do something really harmful to us. And then that we close down, you know, we feel pain and we carry that with us for years. I had a relative do something to me when I was maybe, I don't know how old, 12 or 13. And part of me just closed down for a good number of years. I had a good friend when I was about 15, who said something to me, and I just closed that part of myself down for a number of years as well, and wouldn't show that side to anybody, because it was so painful to have that happen. So what I'm trying to explain with these little examples is that our relationship with each other and how we treat each other, how we were treated, have big impacts on each other, on the world around us. And I don't think we really understand how deep that impact is. Or how deep those social connections are. Some people can be, you know, very busy and kind of ignore it and push it away. Some people develop selfishness as they grow up and also kind of create barriers to understand the depth of it. But even with the barriers, something deep inside is still there that is that's who's waiting for us. So one of the very powerful ways of understanding what's waiting for us, what's deep inside, is to meditate. And one of the strong places is to go on meditation retreats. Because this wonderful process where the mind calms down and the surface discursive mind, the concerns and worries and everything quiets down, as that begins to happen, then what is underneath the surface in our minds and our hearts has a chance to show itself. And what's under the surface in our hearts sometimes is quite beautiful, quite wonderful, and sometimes it's painful. And one of the things that stores there is the memories of things we've done. And it seems that, for most people, that if they've harmed someone, and at the time they didn't care, it didn't really matter, they kind of like forgot it or they forgot about it, it's somehow stored there until it can be processed properly, healed properly, kind of somehow come to surface and gone through properly. And so it's not uncommon for people who go into this deep meditation process to come to a layer in their heart where something gets shown. Oh no. 10, 20, 30, 40 years ago. Oh no. I did this thing. And, you know, I haven't remembered it for all these years, but there it is. It looms really big. And it's kind of like you can't put it down. It's kind of like, oh no, I feel really bad. Now I feel the pain. What did I do? And then it's time to make amends. Then it's time to do something to let that kind of be purified. And it's quite remarkable that something we've done many, many years ago can live underground in us and then surface at some point and do its thing. Kind of and it's, you're pretty lucky if you get to do this when you're still sane. Because then you can, you know, bring your wisdom and your resources and kind of process it and be wise with it. But what happens if you start getting Alzheimer's and or senility? And there, in senility also, your surface mind kind of begins to disappear. You know, and things get kind of simpler and simpler, and the usual protections we have kind of disappear. And then guess what's buried underneath? And then finally, this thing that we've been hiding for a long time, or avoiding, or not even paying, don't even know it's there, has a chance to surface. But now we don't have the resources, the ability to handle it and be wise about it. And there's not a few people who get senility who, as they get senile, become nicer than they were. And there's some people who get senile, they become meaner than they were. And I don't know how much of it has to do with what's buried deep inside and been unresolved. So these things that happen to us, our actions that we do to each other, are consequential. They're really, really actually a big deal. And the purpose of this ethical teaching in Buddhism is not to be moralistic, but it's to care for our own heart so we don't have this legacy or this carry this burden of difficult memories and habits and things in our hearts, in ways in which we've numbed down or closed down. And we don't cause harm for the world around us. So it's in that context, those kinds of actions, that the Buddha focused on when he talked about karma. So he didn't talk about the karma of, you know, of not changing your tires, you know, when the tires are bare, just because of no one told you you're supposed to change tires. You know, it never occurred to you to look at your tires. You know, there's, you know, that's not, you know, you might harm someone when the tires explode on the freeway and your car careens into someone else. But that's not the kind of action. There's a lot of actions that are not considered under this category of ethical karma, ethical action. But the ethical actions that you can do have consequences. And the Buddha said they have consequences in three different times. They can be consequential in this lifetime, they can be consequential in the next lifetime, and they can be consequential in some subsequent lifetime. So sooner or later, it'll come back. Sooner or later, these the impact of these ethical actions, whether they're skillful or unskillful, will come back for you, come back to you. I don't know about this rebirth thing and the multiple life thing. I have no evidence for it. So the way that I like to kind of view this teaching is, because I don't want to dismiss these teachings entirely that I don't understand or don't have evidence for, but I like to respect them and say, well, maybe there's something here for me. And the way that I see these teachings that say, well, there's karma in the next lifetime, what you do now will affect you in the next lifetime, is I like to see that it's a way of saying that we live in an unseen world, that much of what happens to us, we can't always see the, you know, where the plumbing is and where the everything travels. It happens kind of behind, under the surface of discursive mind. And so the way that certain things, like I couldn't have seen that my grandmother bringing me toast when I was a kid would kind of resurface decades later as in a memory that nourishes my body. My body feels kind of warm and soft when I think of that in a very comforting way. How did that happen? Where did that get stored? Or I've had the situation where I've done things that caused harm to people, and then, you know, many, many years later, boom, there it is. What's going on with? I haven't talked to her in 40 years. You know, just because of what I said in high school, I have to sit here and, you know, review it. And how did that happen? So I think there's many unseen ways in which the consequences of our ethical action travels in our hearts, our minds, and travels in society. And so by talking about the unseen world of the next lifetime, for me, I just say, yes, it's unseen, it's unknown how it comes back. But I think it's good to respect the tremendous power of karma. And that's one of the impacts that this Buddhist practice has brought me, that from kind of first-hand experience and also from being a teacher and talking to many people, I now have tremendous respect for the power of karma. It's like a force, you know, this unseen way it kind of way it travels and works through us and comes through. If you really want to care for yourself, be really careful with your ethics. Or say it better, because, you know, we don't want to sound like we're puritanical. If you really want to care for yourself, be careful with the actions that you do that have an impact on others. Avoid actions that harm other people. Do things that are beneficial and supportive of them. Be really careful with that. And part of the purpose of mindfulness practice, the whole meditation practice in Buddhism, is to emphasize where we have a choice to make a difference one way or the other. That the whole Buddhist enterprise is based on a premise that we have choice. And you have more choice if you're mindful. The less mindful you are, the less choice you have. If you don't see that you have a choice, you don't have a choice. So if I'm, you know, walking down the street, and the next thing I know is I have an ice cream in my hand, there was no choice. This, you know, there was, I didn't do it. But if I was walking down the street and I saw the ice cream store, and I saw my desire for ice cream arise, I might be present enough to that to say, oh, you know, I have a choice of whether I get an ice cream or not. And if I just had the another ice cream the block before, maybe I decide not now or something, right? So I have a choice. So if we're harried, if we're consumed with our worries, our concerns, our greed, our fears and everything, if we're lost in the future, lost in the past, then it's very easy not to live in that place where we have a choice. In which case, maybe we don't have a choice, and when we don't see we have choice, then we've lost our free will. There is no free will if we don't see the place of choice. There is free will if we see the place of choice. And so important, very important part of mindfulness is to be able to be calm enough, settled enough, contented enough, at ease enough. It's very important, contented enough, to be able to use that place of choice wisely. If we're not content or at ease in some deep way, then our choices can still be pushed by our conditioning and by our desires, by our emotions. So to kind of find a place to be at ease enough, content enough, that we can see the place of choice and act accordingly. And so how do we know which actions to choose? We try to understand the consequences that actions might have. And if the consequences don't cause harm, then maybe it's best not to do it. If they're beneficial, then maybe we can do it. If we see that they're going to be harmful to people, why are you still doing it? And the part of the mindfulness practice would be to answer that question for yourself. Why you want to say something to someone that's mean, and you know the person deserves it after all, right? So might as well, you know, do your little dig. But you see, that might be harmful for the person. Why do I want to do it? What's going on in me? And you say, well, in my great infinite wisdom, I think that it's beneficial to this person for me to tell him, her, that you stink. Well, maybe. That's maybe once in a million years, that's the right intervention. Maybe. But you know, if you really look, what's going on inside of you when you want to do something, you clearly see the consequences are going to be hurtful for someone, you think it's going to be. Chances are, if you really see why, what's going on in you, you're probably not very settled on yourself. You're probably not, the quality of your inner life is probably not very good. There's probably not a lot of peace there, ease there. It's probably discontent. If you see that what you're going to, if you see the consequence of what you're going to do is likely to cause benefit for people, you can ask the same question. Why do I want to do it? And there you might see that there's kind of a mixed bag of questions. Sometimes it might be because you really want to support them, want to help them. And sometimes you see, well, if I do this good thing for the person, I'll get a raise. Or if I do this good thing for this person, you know, the person will do me favors. All kinds of other reasons, right? So you can look at that, and then you can look at the quality of what goes on in your heart on these different motivations for why you want to do these actions. And you can be the caretaker of those inner choices, of this, the quality of your own heart. And in the end, I think, or in the beginning or something of Buddhist practice, only you can be the custodian, only you can be the gardener of your own heart, only you can be the caretaker of the quality of your heart. And it's probably, I believe, that the quality of your heart, the inner state that you have, is the most important thing that you own, that you have. It's the most precious resources that you'll ever encounter. It's the most intimate and valuable thing that you have. It's a great jewel that you carry with you. That it's more valuable than your bank account, your house, your car, all kinds of things. And it's much more portable. And you can take it with you when you become homeless, for example. You can take it with you with the next Great Depression, you know. I don't mean to be funny. I mean, this is really, you know, who knows what's going to happen next to any of us, right? And so to learn how to take care of the quality of our own inner life so we don't get afraid, we don't get angry, we don't get contracted is one of the great tasks of a human life, to be able to keep our heart, our mind open, peaceful, and contented in some deep, appropriate way, so that we can you know, make those choices that help us support our community, bring benefit to the world around us, bring benefit to ourselves. And I think this is also one of the great tasks of a human life, is our social life is so important for all of us. And it's so important for us as individuals, us as a community, and for all of us to take good care of ourselves. That in taking care of the quality of our own heart, then we're able to take care of the quality of our community as well. So when the Buddha talked about karma, from what I can tell, he was talking about particular kind of actions, and those particular actions have consequences, and those consequences are worth taking into account. And the particular actions he was most focused on were the ethical actions about how we live together with others. And the consequences of those actions are something we need to take into account if we want to kind of live a wise life and follow a path to freedom. So I hope that, two things. I hope that that made some sense to you. And it was nice for you to hear a little bit about this interpretation of the Buddha's teaching on karma. And I hope I had it right. Enough, otherwise maybe it's bad karma. So we have six minutes or so before the end. If you want to ask any questions or comment on this, you're welcome to, or any protests.
I've often heard that intention is one of the properties of action. Is that contained in the act of choosing?
Yeah, it's a kind of a very popular, very central teaching in much of Buddhism is that that really what characterizes action karma, or the underlying thing, is the intention. And you study the intention to understand the ethical quality of the karmic act. But intention means the purpose, means the purpose for which you want a consequence for. And so the intention and consequence are not so far away from each other. So the Buddha himself didn't speak very much about intentionality behind the action. He focused more on the consequences and studying those. But it's a when we can see the intention, the reason why, the purpose for why we want to say or do something, then we have much closer to the place where we can choose, which I think is your question. If we don't see the intention, there's probably little choice, or harder to have a choice.
So, it's not always easy to see something in between a fully good consequence and a fully bad consequence, right? And you're thinking about the consequences of your actions. There's some limits on what you can see about the consequences.
You can only do the best you can.
Right, so that was the question. What do you do when it's kind of in between and you're not sure?
Well, it depends on the situation. Sometimes you might ask. Ask around. Ask your friend, you know. I'm thinking of something, and what do you think? So asking, you know, or just investigating, considering it. And sometimes it's very hard to know, and that's when the idea of intention becomes very big for some people. Some people then take refuge in their intention. They'll spend a lot of time studying, why do I want to do this? What's motivating me? And if they can find nothing unwholesome, unskillful in the motivation, then they say, I'm going to give it my best shot and try this. But if you only focus on the quality of your intention, I mean, they say, isn't there saying that the road to hell is paved with good intentions? So if you only look at your intentions without looking at the consequences, you might really not understand that what you're about to do is not so useful. Helen, in the back.
So, what did the Buddha teach about making amends?
Making amends.
Mm.
I don't know. I don't think it. I think it's a good sometimes to make amends. Sometimes we have to. That's the only way to settle things. I think that's true. But I don't know if he said so much about it. I don't know. I haven't seen it. I mean, what the Buddha does talk about is that if we do something unskillful that causes harm, we should go and tell a wise person about it. So I didn't want to use the English word confession because that's pretty loaded. But go find someone who you think is wise and let them know what happened. And because if we do something unskillful, harmful, and we just carry it inside ourselves, we might not really learn fully from it or really disown it fully or really step away from it or really kind of find our way with it properly. But if we're a little bit accountable to someone we respect and we think is wise, say, you know, I did this thing. And then sometimes it's kind of, it's easier to take responsibility or see it more clearly. Or what the Buddha talked about was, tell someone who's wise and have them support you to not do it again. That makes sense? But so I don't know much about, in terms of your question, I don't know much about in Buddhism, about making amends, teachings like that. But I think I think sometimes it's really necessary.
Thank you.
So as we meditate, self-criticism and self-judgment are supposed to kind of fall off. How can you judge your own actions and decide whether you're being skillful or unskillful if self-criticism and self-judgment are going away?
Well, I apologize to say that this has something to do with semantics what we mean by judgment and criticism. And maybe we can just kind of step back from how many people in English nowadays think judgment is, you know, if you're judging someone, you're bad. You should not judge anyone, right? But we can evaluate people.
Wise discernment.
We can be discerning, right? Wise discernment. But we can't judge people. That's wrong. But let's kind of just kind of... but to discern, to judge, to evaluate, to consider what's going on, to evaluate the situation is what human beings do. And you're, as you get wiser, you're expected to do more of that, actually. But it's possible to judge with hostility, to evaluate with hostility, and it's possible to evaluate with generosity, with care and compassion. So if you're being self-critical, I mean, I found myself that as I matured in Buddhist practice, I became more keenly sensitive to my shortcomings, to the ways that I would cause harm to people, the kind of things, and much more than I would had before I started doing Buddhist practice. But there was very little condemnation, self-condemnation. There was very no self-hate about it, or, you know, hostility towards myself. In fact, sometimes, but I mean, most of the time, not always, it was like, oh, great. One more thing to practice with. One more thing to work with, you know. And as opposed to, you know, Gil, you're a lousy stinker. So does that make sense what I'm saying?
It does.
So yes, please, as you don't give up your wonderful capacity to evaluate and make distinctions and see what's going on, but let go of the hostility that's behind
okay.
it.
Thanks.
Okay. So thank you all for coming and practicing here today, and I appreciated you all being here.